Hello, and welcome back to the Bentley Priory Museum podcast. This podcast has been established alongside a temporary exhibition called Defending Britain from Nazi and Nuclear Threat. Bentley Priory Museum is currently running this project to investigate its top secret underground bunker, which was used both in the Second World War and the Cold War periods. This podcast will be highlighting some of the exciting stories of the personnel who work down in the bunker. This episode is called Down the Hole, a term that was commonly used by those who work down in the bunker. Today we will be learning more about the bunker by delving into the first-hand accounts of those who worked there and gain an understanding of their experiences when they first started working down the hole. Right from the Second World War with the Women's Auxiliary Air Force, where there is mention of the King and Air Chief Marshal Sir Hugh Dowding on site. To those who come much later as part-time staff, such as the Royal Observer Corps during the Cold War, not to mention a ghost story from the bunker a little later on. So I invite you to sit back and listen as we are joined by Chloe Marley, who is the project officer for the museum. She will give you an insight into the role of the bunker, along with Tim Wilbond from the Association of Royal Air Force Fighter Control Officers.
As Headquarters Fighter Command, RAF Bentley Priory was home to the filter room and operations room, which were the central components of the Dowding system during the Battle of Britain and Second World War. The role of the filter room was to analyse, as accurately as possible, the information coming in from the numerous radar stations around the British coast. When Air Chief Marshal Sir Hugh Dowding arrived at RAF Bentley Priory in 1936, he realised that he needed a system to marry up all this information from radar stations and combine it with other data from the Observer Corps posts and air intelligence reports. The answer was to provide a separate table in addition to the one for filtering radar reports. Dowding recognised that the most crying need was for operations rooms at all commands and stations with tables on, which the courses of all aircraft, hostile and friendly, could be tracked. From then on, the filtered radar information was sent from the filter room to the command group and sector operations rooms, where it was used to help the fighter squadrons successfully intercept enemy aircraft. Although the two rooms had very different functions, they did look quite similar. There was a map table which WAF and RAF personnel worked around, and above them was a balcony or bridge where more senior officers could oversee events and information could be viewed and passed on. Here, Tim Wilbond from the Association of Royal Air Force Fighter Control Officers describes the role and purpose of an operations room.
An operations room is where commanders within the span of control that they have, within the area of responsibility, exercise that authority to manage a battle or an operation. And so that operations room has to have the picture of what's going on, plus a whole host of information, weather information, wind information, about all the airfields in their area, about all the squadrons, where they are, what's happening, readiness route, weapon stocks, you know, a whole vast amounts of information come together there. So the commander has all that at his fingertips when he's having to make decisions.
Initially, the filter and operations room were housed in the main mansion house at RAF Bentley Priory, but they became so important that they were moved to the newly built bunker on the grounds where they could withstand attack.
As Chloe mentioned, the bunker played an extremely important role during the Second World War. We have been lucky enough to interview members of the Women's Auxiliary Air Force who worked down in the bunker during the Second World War.
My first morning there was with eight other girls, and they said, "We want you to come down, and you've got to walk down the steps." And we were going down into this hole, and into the room, you know, and the King was there with Dowding up on the balcony. Filter room was so new that didn't know how it was going to work, let alone the ones that were going to do it at the beginning of the war.
It was a passage. Dave came down the stairs, right down into the depth of the... And the ops room was over there. And that was down below. But the balcony where the officers were taking all the notes went all the way round. You've got the Home Office people there, and then the Army there, the Navy there. They were all different officers there. And then the Air Force ones, of course.
Yes, I mean, it was... You couldn't see into anywhere. You had corridors and you had doors going into places. You weren't meant to. And strange enough, we didn't. We didn't know what was... I knew the operations rooms next door. And we had a little nook there where we had our own lady who used to serve tea, was it? and yellow peril. Yellow cake, which was available if you wanted it. You had to be starving. And once in a while, we'd see different people there, but you didn't talk to anyone. This was one of the things.
Much later in the war, the filter room was moved out of the bunker. Here, Tim talks about the role of the bunker after the Second World War as changes to the RAF took place.
Fighter Command was disbanded in 1968 and Strike Command was set up. Prior to that, Bentley Priory and its bunker had been Fighter Command, and the bunker was the Air Defence Operations Centre for Fighter Command. Fighter Command responsible for the air defence of the whole country. After that, they reintroduced the group structure, but it changed from being geographically based to functionally based. That then went, so when Strike Command set up, the groups became functional, and 11 Group, which was formed, became the Air Defence Group. So 11 Group effectively took over the Fighter Command role, but as a group under the CNC Act, Strike Command, but doing exactly the same thing. The UK Air Defence, it's just then known as 11 Group from 1968, and that was the functional task was air defence of the United Kingdom. And the AOC, the Air Office commanding the group, this was two-star, and he became the air defence commander for the commander-in-chief. And he exercised his operational responsibility through the bunker at Bentley Priory for some time.
Now we have some voices of those who worked in the bunker during the Cold War period, many of whom were part-time personnel, such as Margaret Parsons, who worked evening shifts in the bunker. She would have had a very different experience to those who worked there in the day.
I said we walked from the car park only down a very short pathway between some prefab buildings, and we made the entrance. It came into an entrance which was on ground level, but as far as I can remember, it was set into a hillside. But actually going down into the underground complex, it was quite weird because there would only perhaps be two or three night shift RAF people on duty. The building was almost empty because we were coming on duty at 8 o'clock at night. So they were only had a skeleton staff on. So we didn't really meet anybody down. Once we went down there, we just buzzed the door and said who we were. And somebody somewhere in the building let us in. And it was lots and lots of stairs and lots of corridors going down and down and down and along and down and down and down and along. Then we would go down to two rooms down there, two offices. One overlooked to the main plotting area where we could just plot all the fallout and practice doing it. So really, yes. And then at 10 o'clock at night, we'd just come back out again and get in the cars and go home again. So that was really... Didn't really meet many people. There wasn't many people here to meet.
We referred to the bunker never as a bunker. Air defence hot down the hole. That was the term amongst all airmen, you know, working there.
Just simply going downstairs. One was very conscious of air conditioning, and strangely enough, when I come to think about it, it was the smell of floor polish, because there was a walkway around the entire building on both levels, both stories, which were continually polished by a group of cleaners dedicated to that. And they had an electric cleaner or electric polisher, and those floors were glass, shiny, very, very clean, probably about 8 feet wide, and they ran around the perimeter of the entire underground block on both floors. Incidentally, I think now, in retrospect, that there were actually three floors or more. We didn't know about the other floors, but I can't believe for a moment that a secure bunker to take an atomic blast would not have had restrooms and dormitories and total facilities for all ranks.
Well, I think the first impression when you got to the bunker, obviously, you wasn't a great deal to see above ground. But like all bunkers, there's always a concrete, a couple of concrete entrances with big, big, solid, huge doors, blast doors. So, and maybe a hump in the ground, which is still, incidentally, still there. I think the impression that when you first go in, and having been in other ops rooms which were dug into the earth, was how far down, the number of floors. Now, I confess, I do forget how many levels there were, but you seem to be able to go down and down and down and down, down forever. And of course, you're going through plant rooms, which were looking after the conditioning, air conditioning, and making sure that was all filtered. So there's a hum there. It's a bit like going down into the bowels of a ship, until you actually got to the operations room with all the operations boards, the desks and the communications areas.
As the threat of nuclear war increased, in 1958, the Royal Observer Corps formed a nuclear reporting cell within the bunker to pass on details of nuclear attack and the resulting fallout to the RAF. However, following from the 1968 restructure, the bunker had an increasingly less central role in the air defence of Britain. In 1971, the bunker became more of a standby facility as most operations were moved to the Strike Command Operations Centre at High Wycombe.
As you can hear, the bunker had an impact on so many people's lives throughout its operational life. A place so secretive, yet holding so many fond memories to those who spent their time down the hole. Just like those who worked so hard at Bentley Priory, this project wouldn't have been possible without the fantastic volunteers who worked to gather these oral histories. So we are joined now by Dave Considine, who will talk you through what he has done and learnt through this project so far.
My name is Dave Considine, and I've recently retired after 36 years in the civil service. I live locally with a very keen interest in local history and the Priory in particular. My wife founded a NAFI there in the 1980s, so it's local and very dear to us. Aviation history is relatively recent and therefore within living memory or anecdotal testimony written in books or viewed on grainy newsreel. I volunteer for this project as it's excitingly to effectively live the experience of those who were there, not only when Bentley Priory was at Fighter Command headquarters, but through the Cold War and afterwards. Having worked in a team environment, I'm interested to learn of the structure of the management and control and command of the RAF and the structure of how all the various personnel fitted in, from the tellers to the observers, to the guards on the gate, to the brass at the top, and the current trustees who have the responsibility to bring the Priory to the public. And I'm honoured to have had the opportunity to conduct some interviews with some of the people that actually served at the Priory, and to be part of the team who are conducting what I believe is essential historical research where the events have happened. A matter of interpretation and presentation to the best ends, and I'm proud to have contributed in a small way to such an important project. And whilst I thought I was a good listener, which is important when interviewing people, but the floor belongs to the speaker, and I found that it was very difficult not to engage with such fascinating people. I really enjoy the trace of the evidence, the discovery of new facts, to put them together with existing ones to establish a bigger and better understanding of our heritage for us and future generations. Our fantastic and talented volunteers and the project leads have worked hard to disseminate the relevant facts from material gathered and format them into a podcast and into a tangible exhibition so they can form part of a permanent spoken record.
Although Halloween has just been and gone, it seems somewhat apt to include a tale of a little ghost story from the Priory's bunker.
To enter the bunker, we walked through a doorway to pass through a police checkpoint and then went downstairs to enter a labyrinth of long corridors and stairways. One of the stairways was immaculate in appearance, white walls adorned with long pipelines leading to the bridge, used by senior figures of the services and government. The bridge overlooked the ops room, and from here, those viewing activity could easily ascertain status of various areas of the southeast of the country and surrounding coastlines, with regard to airborne or grounded aircraft. The upper floor of the bunker held the canteen, which was just really a room holding a kettle and toaster and a sink, and numerous cups and mugs. There were no facilities to cook. While on a night shift, we were provided with sandwiches from the mess. During day shifts, we made toast or sandwiches. The corridors were eerily quiet. As a 17-year-old, I listened with interest but concern to the stories told to me by my older colleagues of the ghost of Lady Hamilton, who walked the corridors of the bunker at night looking for her dead baby. As I was the one sent to make the coffees and teas on nights, I was always scared walking to and from the canteen. My fears were never appeased when the air conditioning system made whooshing noises when switching on and off, and as it went off, static in the air used to raise the hair on your head as if a balloon had been rubbed over it. Scary stuff. One night, when in the canteen, I had practically run down the corridor as the whooshing of the air conditioning had taken its toll on my hair. I stood with my back to the door boiling the kettle. I heard a scratching noise on the other side of the door and a ghoulish soft voice calling my name. I cannot convey how frightened I was that at last Lady Hamilton had come looking for her baby and was about to confront me. The door had a porthole in it, and as I turned to see her, I was horrified to see a grey-haired, thin and gaunt ghost.
Thank you for joining us. Unfortunately, the museum will now be closed until the first week of December due to the ongoing restrictions and lockdown in the UK. However, we will be back with another episode very soon to cover your interest until the museum can open again. However, the current exhibition will be on till spring 2021, so there's still plenty of time to visit and experience the exhibition firsthand. We are also currently coming up to Remembrance Day, so I'd just like to say that we all remember those who have served to protect our country from the First World War right up until the present day. We can all stand together to thank those who risked their lives to protect and keep peace to our country, among many others around the world. I hope you can join us for the next episode, called Intercept, where we will listen to the roles of the personnel who worked in the bunker and gain a better understanding of its vital importance in protecting Britain from Nazi and nuclear threat. Thank you.